How much for the Buddha? How much for the Dharma? How much for the Sangha? Sound check 1 2 1 2. Thumbs up from Tony. Thank you. All right. So here we are again. Joshin was going to do the Dharma talk today, but she got sick yesterday, and so I'm here. It's probably a good thing that I didn't know I was going to do it on Thursday, because then I would have had to write the blurb. And it's a talk on distraction, and who wants to come talk about distraction or listen to a talk about a distraction? So you weren't forewarned. You're all here. Great. Refresh off Denkoe Sesshin. And so that works its way in here a little bit. It was a really pleasant, really tranquil Sesshin. It was small, but quite solid. So that feeds in. Another thing that is feeding into this for me is a Wednesday night class a few weeks ago on the Kalita Sutta. So expanding on some threads that showed up in that discussion. I had the thought after that class that I wanted to, at some point, do a Dharma talk that was basically like trying to define a lot of similar words that we kind of throw around but are maybe a little sloppy, like mind and consciousness and attention and awareness and big mind and things like that. Right, that we can kind of nod and understand in a sentence, but like, what if we drill down a little? That's a Dharma talk that I wished for when I was newer in practice. And this isn't really that talk, but it started there. I thought too many definitions would be kind of be tiring to have to try to keep straight if you're listening. So distraction is what's happening when we're trying to do multiple things at the same time. It sounds simple, but we're a room full of complicated people. We're often doing multiple things at one time. So if we're listening to a Dharma talk and we're breathing, like, that's not distraction. That's fine. Please keep breathing. If we're listening to a Dharma talk, but we're also planning our afternoon, right? That's distraction. Both activities require intent. They require volitional oomph. So there's a conflict there. In Sanskrit, it's vikshepa, which means throwing or casting outward, which is very similar to like distract in English. The root is to pull away. The opposite in Sanskrit, samadhi, is to focus the mind on, to gather the mind, to collect it. Vikshepa is one of 20 unwholesome mental factors, one of the in the like this primary and secondary. It's one of the 20 secondary ones in Mahayana Abhidharma. And so, like, big picture, Buddhism likes samadhi, right? It appreciates one-pointedness. Right concentration is one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path. Zen also appreciates concentration. And it's hard. We find if we are meditating that the mind frequently wanders, right? It gets easier, but it is hard. It's looking at that problem, it's easy to throw outward, right? It's easy to notice how many distractions there are around us. What a complex and fast-paced world we live in, how much information there is that we have the opportunity to process, a jarring amount of stimuli that we might perceive. So all that's true, and like the Buddhist tact here is not to blame the distractions for being there, right? Like it's just arising, it's just causation. Part of the teaching of the Denka Roku that we worked on this week, the chapter that we focused on, was that eyes just perceive light, ears just perceive vibration, mind just perceives thought, right? There's a simplicity to it. There's like, it's just arising based on conditions. It doesn't require any volition. It's immediately there. Contact is made, boom. If instead of throwing outward, we gather together enough, we notice that attention is moving to each of those different stimuli. That's volitional, right? It doesn't have to. It's quick, but it's not automatic. That's part of our capacity and responsibility. And that's, you know, that's Buddhism's offer, right? Like, this is within our scope. This is within our sphere of influence, how the mind works. So let's own that. And if we're doing that, then we see that really the reason why it's hard to concentrate is internal, right? If we meditate, we find that, sure, there's this ongoing supply of external input, but there's also this ongoing supply of internal input. And much of that boils down to protecting the sense of self. So it's practically useful and spiritually profound to have more control over how attention moves around, how, like, to have more capacity to catch it, to notice that it moved, to have more capacity to hold it in one place, to have more capacity to decide where to put it, right? All three aspects. So that's true. And it's also true that all of us are distracted with some frequency, right? So there's some tension there between aspiration and reality. And so if you know that about yourself, and you also hear me saying rah, rah, rah for attention, you might be feeling a little defensive. And so I wanna talk about that, because that's interesting. There's a couple of different threads that resistance might take, right? So one thing I hear both internally and externally is that, like, I have to be distracted. It's inevitable, right? So it's true, like, attention is going to move. Concentration, like a concentrated mind, involves many instances of noticing that attention has moved and bringing it back. That's part of concentration. But that's different from willful distraction, right? So that slipping, there's a certain inevitability to that most of the time. The willful choosing to be distracted is not inevitable. Another one is that, like, because it's so common and because it's so, like, just kind of baked in, a lot of us really feel like it's okay to be distracted. And like, it's okay in a big sense. but it hurts. And like, we're not very, humans are not that great at assessing how we rank relative to the broader group of humans, right? That's just something that's known. Most people think they're good drivers, for instance, right? But we can't really do multiple volitional things at one time well. What happens is that attention has to shuttle back and forth between multiple streams of activity. And we can do that. We can do that, you know, with many different streams. But there's a total amount of capacity. And so, like, just driving, your attention's moving between the rear view mirror, the steering wheel, the odometer, the person next to you, like leave that aside for now. What's on the road in front of you, like your sense of timing, et cetera, right? There's lots of things that you're moving back and forth, and that's all part of the activity of driving. Then if you've got someone next to you, or a song on the radio you really like, or you're playing on your phone, like it's much, like there's more things to like distribute that attention with. There's a finite amount of mind moments, right? Within a certain window. And so there's less, when there's more streams, there's less devoted to what that actual task is, whether if in meditation, to the object of meditation, if it's to a conversation that you're having with someone, right? It could be anything. I was on a bike a few months ago, Sandy and 28th, and someone ran a red light while they were reading the newspaper. They had it like spread over their steering wheel. And like if I was on my bike, and like if they were on a cell phone, I would have been irritated, like, because like that's extra risky for me. But like it was so like, there was this kind of like gruesome appreciation of like the totality of like the full on newspaper. Yeah, it's a certain kind of commitment. Back to the Dharma. I got distracted, right? Part of this is there's this submerged belief that I really only want to spend, say, 20% of who I am on this activity, right? If I'm driving, I'm commuting, like, I don't really want to be there, right? There's something about it which is obligatory. There's something about it which is not satisfying. And we're trying to protect some sense of agency or freedom, and distracting ourselves is a way of doing that. In the choice to distract, there's this little momentary rush of pleasure, right? Like it's a little bit of power, this little squirt of dopamine, right? See if you can catch that real time. So there's this very brief spike in terms of positive vedana, and then this much longer like kind of lethargy that happens, deflation that happens. And that negative vedana is our estrangement from the moment, right? The sense that we're not thoroughly engaged, that disconnect. And it's not pleasant over time. We think that it will be. We might even tell ourselves that it is, but like the distraction. But like if you test it, and so say you have this distraction that you're going to engage in, like see if you can test it like 10 or 20 times, right? In a 20-minute window. Like, am I enjoying this right now? A bulk of those, probably what I find is I'm not, right? It's pretty consistent. There's the initial turn towards, which is pleasant, and then much of what follows is less pleasant. It can be hard to notice because the story of, like, the expectation of escape, the story of relief is so kind of compelling and expected. So test that, you know, see if you can prove that pattern. It's well within the spectrum of sensible phenomena. Like phenomenologically, also like neurotransmitter release and brain activation, right? And The Buddha talked about this 2,500 years ago. So there's a lot of evidence that this is actually how it works. It's suffering causing suffering. Because I have resistant to the current arising of reality, I commit less to it. It's a tragic loop. Another point of contention around distraction is that we tend to think that's just who we are, right? We get identified with our pet distractions. And, you know, so there's some truth there in that, like, causally, we're the result of past action. But there's also a falsehood in that that is a tiny piece of who we actually are. Who we are is vast and constantly changing. And we don't want to lose touch with that. If we are thorough and wholehearted about engaging this sliver of reality right in front of us, that way of being becomes more of who we are. Sometimes our experience is really unpleasant. And despite that, life is much, much more satisfying when we meet it thoroughly. Fourth, we convince ourselves that it would be useful, right? That something that we're experiencing or usually about to experience is just too much. So, like, there's some skillful means here, right? Some things actually are too much. If we find ourselves in a panic state, we're sliding dorsal vagal or whatever, we're like moving the mind to a different object can be therapeutic, right? Feeling your feet, playing with your phone, whatever, right? Like, it's better than like frozen. So it's on us to recognize when that's actually the case and when we're using it kind of preemptively as a justification, right? Part of the things that I look for is like, is there a willingness to re-engage at some point? If it feels like a hard no, even if I'm dressing it up, then like, clearly I'm trying to get away with something. Clearly I'm avoiding. If we're escaping, it's hard to harbor that possibility of re-engagement, right? If we're being skillful, it's more of a stepping back in order to be more present, be more available. Another thing I hear is that people say that we just can't do it. It just doesn't work for us, right? Like a classic skeptical doubt. And like, you know, we're really complex bags of liquid and things can get out of order and not work right. And it's true. So, but outside of some pretty severe imbalances or deficiencies, like, you know, losing chunks of the brain to a stroke or car accident, mostly we do have this capacity. It's just a long road. But I recognize that there can be some hopelessness around this, right? If you are trying to sit and you just find yourself lost again and again and again, right? It can be demoralizing. There's gross and subtle distraction, right? So with both, there's some alternation between the task at hand, whether it's a conversation, whether it's sensation of breath, whether it's shikantaza, and whatever the distraction is. If the meditation object is the primary focus of attention, and more time is spent there than on the distraction, then that's subtle distraction that we're talking about. If more time is spent on the distraction, until at some point we forget about that we were meditating or having a conversation or driving a car, That's a gross distraction. So it's really actually useful, healthy, wholesome, skillful to notice subtle distraction, right? To note, oh yeah, like there's that little arising. That's condition, that's phenomena, that's something. Like if we notice it as such, it's much less likely to turn into gross distraction, right? If we, so that just that kind of noting can be really helpful. If it's not okay to notice it because we're doing it wrong, like that's a much more precarious approach to meditation, right? Which leads to longer periods of distraction. You want to actually like be happy about catching the distractions. And it makes it more pleasant. Yeah, don't beat yourself up when you're distracted. When you're distracted. Yeah, so don't think that because distractions are happening, that means you can't concentrate. Right? Like it's just part of the process. It's developing concentration. There's more to go into there, but if let's leave that for now. I guess what I will say is that you could tell a similar story about gross and subtle dullness on the other end of the activity spectrum. So like distraction is like kind of too much buzz. Dullness is not enough buzz. And like we're most clear, we're most aware, like in the center. So it's endless fine-tuning there. Okay, so that's me trying to respond to some of the resistance that shows up around distraction. As far as the positive case, I also want to offer that. Paying attention is really pleasant. If there's like, watch when something is not satisfying, right? It could be that you're just bored. It could be that a conversation has taken a turn you don't like. It could be, whatever. Watch for the urgency signal, like the little red light that starts to blink flat faster, that tells you this isn't okay. Anxiety, boredom, loneliness, whatever. The trick is that, like, we have some impression that it's going to get much worse. And that's just the mechanism, right? Like, that's not reality. That's just like how this bag of liquid is put together. And so that's what pushes on the distraction, right? That's what, like, invites us to do it, is that red light beeping saying, I'm not okay. Where it's about to not be okay. So if you can see that as pattern, that's really helpful. The next step, and so just knowing that, like, hey, that is a pattern I could watch for, that's some leverage. See if you can catch it. And then see if you can catch it under a wider variety of situations. And then see if you can catch more subtle versions of it. When we catch it, watch what happens if you don't distract, if you just stay with it. Very consistently, I mean, tell me if this isn't the case, but what I find is that the urgency dissipates pretty quickly. It's astonishing. It doesn't quite seem fair, but it works. You may have to repeat it. You may have to do it again and again because, like, the loneliness, the anxiety keeps coming back. But when we just be with it, it drops, it dissolves. And every time you do that, you take that little cycle, that's building a different kind of habit. Also, when we maintain a sense of attention on something, the delight and appreciation grows. It's not the pleasant sensation that comes from like direct sense contact. it's something that we can sense, but it's it comes from like a dwelling in a commitment to a task, an object, a sensation, a kind of seclusion or pulling back from casting out, from frittering or diluting our life energy. When we refrain from doing that, that sense of ease and enjoyment builds. Often we notice it once we've stopped kind of like trying to concentrate and we kind of settled into it a little bit. So it's not right away. You have to have a little momentum, but then there's a payoff. And it's not just pleasant, it's also more meaningful, right? Who we are is more receptive. We're accessing deeper layers, and so there's more insight. So often when we're talking about concentration, it's in relation to meditation, and that's a great way to engage it. But, and I would say like a lot of like my key experiences were in meditation and on Sesshin. But in terms of like the bulk of like how I did most of my work in terms of developing attentional stability was mindfulness, right? Fish is on that bandwagon. Yeah. I mean, it's just so constant, like the opportunity. Like we only get to meditate a couple hours a day, but like we get to be mindful, like, you know, like 16 hours-ish, right? Like a lot. It's a big difference. So if we're not mindful, we're either caught or we're about to be. So it's really nice to be mindful. And it doesn't have to be anything in particular. It can be exactly this. Like, so if like you're looking out the window, and your attention is shuttling between looking out the window and, you know, like the hurdles and complexities of your work and social life, then like the sympathetic nervous system is rolling, right? Like our subjective experience is swimming upstream. It's not like, wow, letting that in. The view looks like worry, right? Rather than beauty. So it does take some time to just look out the window, right? That's time that you're not doing anything else, but also like, wow, like, like it's immediately fulfilling. It's immediately a good use of time. It's emphatically a better use of time than dwelling in stress and practicing that habit. I want to, this felt like kind of a more loosely put talk, put together talk. But I want to end with a quote from Bendhova. Although this inconceivable Dharma is present in each person, it is not actualized without practice and it is not experienced without realization.
We now have the opportunity for some questions and comments. If you're in the room, go ahead and raise your hand and I'll bring the mic to you. Please say your name so we know who you are before you begin your question or comment. If you are on Zoom, you can go ahead and put your question in the chat and the co-host will take the next steps from there.
Hi, my name is Ed. So there's a sort of an interesting tension that comes up for me in this idea of distraction. There's the way you were presenting it in terms of our deliberate or volitional distraction and the balance between our attention and various things. But there's another way that it seems to come up in like the post-meditation realm where, you know, it's like tea time, the coffee, and the cookies go pretty well with it, you know, and it's the opportunity to have a more complete experience or something that, you know, maybe in my naive view, it's like, well, I should just be sipping my coffee and being mindful. You know what I mean? Or coming to the Zen Center, it's like, these people are wearing funny clothes. Isn't that a distraction?
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually, it's a part of a complete larger thing. So it's that it's an interesting distinction.
And I think there is like, there's multiple modalities with which to explore this. So I think like formal seated meditation is one, right? Like that has, like it's quite powerful, it's quite narrow, it's specific. There's pros and cons. Like a dedicated specific mindfulness practice around like brushing your teeth and attending to sensation, right? Would be another. Like that's somewhere in between, like tea time where you're talking, drinking, eating, mingling, you know, all at once. Like that's another, right? Like there's and I feel like I want us to be really full people. I want us to have access to many, many modes of expression. And so what is mindfulness like in that, right? Like it's not going to be as like one-pointed, right? It's not going to be as obvious. It's going to be more diffuse. There's going to be more like peripheral to it. But we can still like have this sort of like introspective awareness of like noting like, oh yeah, like this is who I am right now, right? And if we're attuned to that, and we're attuned to that over time, like we notice when we divert, like we notice when like, ooh, like I'm getting away with something right now, or like, or I'm resisting something right now, or whatever it is, like we catch those divergences. Oh wow, that row has lots of questions.
Hi, my name's Annie Rose. I guess I'm used to more anxiety around this year because I always had Flipper getting ready to come out at the end of March, beginning of April, and all of a sudden that anxiety is like not there. Like, wow, like I'm so happy gets to come out and play and do all this stuff. Now it's like, well, what am I going to do? And what's been driving me up the wall now is that I haven't been doing downward facing dog. So I've been finding a lot more time to do downward facing dog and trying to figure out how to get it in my schedule. And I started doing it every Saturday morning.
Huh.
So things have changed. So yeah.
Nice. Well, I'm glad that like you're keeping life sort of flexible and able to keep noticing like what's working for you and what's not, and finding creative ways to play with that.
Yeah.
We're in a row. I'm Guy. I was thinking about how I'm always hearing we're in an attention economy. And, what do you think about the Sangha as a way to kind of protect our, stores of attention from those who might sap it for their own not necessarily wholesome purposes? And that's sort of part of what I think maybe we're
sure here. I think there's plenty of pressure to dissipate, right? But there's also plenty of inspiration to coalesce. And I think that's part of why people appreciate coming here is seeing live examples of people who are committed to being wholehearted in their life. And it's really challenging and it's really beautiful. So we get front row seats here.
And also, maybe we shouldn't beat ourselves up too much if we're aware that we are kind of, besieged by Mara, and the kind of the shock troops of Mara.
I agree that we don't need to be beaten up, and also we have sovereignty over our mind, and own that.
You just described my entire week. That was cool. That doesn't usually happen after a session.
Great.
Just kind of spent the whole talk. Like, yeah, that's what happens. Mm. Thank you. I could add a few questions and comments to that. Two things. I was laughing. I think a couple things you said relate specifically to the chapter we read. One was a line that says, all of us are just the five elements. And the or the five aggregates and the four elements, and I had that underlined with a exclamation mark because it just seemed so humbling and true, and all of this complexity is just
bags of liquid.
Yeah, and it's sometimes that helps me, just to remember that simplicity. Mm-hmm. The other thing that comes up from the reading and your talk is the poem at the end, which we never talked about in your talks, at least, and it's this. Length of white silk. And I read two different translations of that. And in one, it says, dust and dirt are cut off. And the other, it says, nowhere does not land or something like mm-hmm. that. So I was thinking about that both because I'll be talking about the Platform Sutra in a couple of weeks, and mm-hmm. also because the way that you talked about distraction, I've experienced that differently when I'm kind of more in a shikantaza, and it's more of a, there's a deeper sense of acceptance around karma, around distraction. Mm-hmm. And for myself with concentration, it's there is kind of a cutting off, but it doesn't feel like bypassing. It's noticing and then drop away because the real self is so much more vast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a, there's a skill in releasing a thought. And in meditation, being able to do so with as little wake, as little splash. We don't have to throw the thought away. It's just untethered, right? Is no longer attached to us. If that can get really light, then it's, yeah, it helps go deeper.
Did you have a specific reaction to the length of white silk is cut off?
I heard the, my recollection is that the dust and dirt is cut off.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. It's violent language, but I don't really mind.
I liked it too. Thank you.
Morning, it's Blind Fish. So I thought it was a bonus that we're going to have a day of mindfulness after Seishin because you can see the direct connection between the meditation and mindfulness. But uber bonus is this talk. So, I just wanted to bring up that mindfulness can be cultivated.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's why a number of us are offering this day of mindfulness, but in your talk that really struck me was two things. One was the delight in the moment when we stop our mind from the fear of connecting to this activity or the moment that we're in. And it really resonated for me to hear that and realize that's just what I'm enjoying, is that peace. And also the fear of actually really getting in touch with that fear of maybe this isn't enough, this world isn't enough. I don't want to be disappointed. And to notice that that's at the root of a lot of my distraction. I'm wondering if you could just say a few words about the connection between meditation and mindfulness for you.
That's not where I thought you were going there. Okay, but I'll try to answer that question. I feel like in mindfulness, I'm not necessarily trying to go deep. I'm just trying to stay constant. I'm trying to stay close, which is different. There's a really broad field. So there's whatever it is I'm engaged in, but I stay aware of quite a range of stuff, right? It's just that, And I think I think part of what happens with mindfulness is that, for me, what I appreciate about it is it's a little more shikantaza versus concentration to some extent, just putting it in Zazen terms. But if I'm doing something, if I'm engaged in a conversation, I've got a task, tends to be a zooming in on that. Letting that zooming in be pretty light, right? Like it can happen and it can unhappen fairly quickly. That capacity to pivot feels important, that I can stay receptive to what are the surprising birdsong, right? Sensation in my forearm. All those little things that are also part of experience. And it's just kind of a way of staying tethered here.
Would you say that, I remember Rita Gross saying to me, to go deep, you have to go wide. And to go wide, you have to go deep. That kind of sounds like what you're saying about the relationship, maybe?
Yeah, but I don't think you do them both at the same time. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Hi, it's Grant. So I've worked with a lot of children that may have some attention deficits. How would you approach a child with trying to keep presence and attention?
I was actually thinking of that during Fish's question because there's so many really appreciating something, allowing for that to be an activity is really kids get it, and the Montessori preschool, that's mostly what they're doing all day is teaching mindfulness. They have these works and where they're stocking blocks in a particular way, or what, you know, whatever it is, or crushing eggs, or, you know, grinding coffee, or, but like, but the, like how to do it is like, what are the sensations, and like, and how does it look when it's done? And like all these, like trying to make it as full an experience as possible. And like, I've found that kids like get that. It's exciting for an experience to be really full and for there to be space to really like delve into something like that. And yeah, I think there's a certain amount of like cultural skepticism and like kind of goal orientedness which gets in the way of that. And so I think it's kind of a allowing and a safety thing to some extent. Big picture.
I think also not transitioning to the next activity straight away if they're engrossed in it.
Can yeah. Allowing, right?
Thank you.
Tony has a question on Zoom.
Go for it.
Okay, all right. Now I can. Just following on quickly from Fisher's question, would you say that going wide is a stage in the direction of going deep? First you have to stay close, then you have to go deep. Or am I getting that wrong?
I would hate to go on record saying it's a particular way. My guess is that it's like it's multiple, and this like there's just layers of an onion, and people are built a little differently, and yeah, so that feels kind of fraught to try to nail that down.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
That may just be my level of clarity, but I wouldn't go there.
Okay, I'll work on it. Thank you.
Yeah, Mioi here. Yeah, thanks for your talk. You talked about the subtle distractions, and I find when I'm sitting in Shikantaza, I will tend to cycle through feeling more my body, being in my body, and then at times feeling the breath, which is both body and mind. But I believe that based on your definition of subtle distraction, that's still there. If I'm kind of like doing that, and maybe I'm doing that in part so I don't stay in my head so much by being in my body. So can you say a little bit about that? Just the moving through these different techniques, I guess.
I see. Yeah, so say you have like three different meditation techniques that you're partaking of, mm-hmm. And you're kind of bouncing between them. Like they may each be like a wholesome place to put energy, but if you're not, you know, deepening into it, like you're kind of dissipating some of that possibility. I think, like practically speaking, like, you know, there might be a period where you're getting going in meditation, and you might pass through a couple of things. You're trying to find what's sticking right now. You know, you're just kind of getting the bearings and letting like the day kind of slough off a little bit and land. But once there's a little bit of landing, I would say stick with what you're doing and don't cycle through, because it's, it's missing some of what's available.
Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe, oh.
Hello, this is Zach here. One thing you said that really stood out to me was at the beginning when you described distraction as something, I don't know what the words exactly were, but it was like something that happens when we try to do multiple things or something mm-hmm. to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that really stood out to me because it that definition almost assigns level of responsibility for the act of getting distracted to the individual that normally isn't there. What I mean by that is like normally we talk about getting distracted as like something that happens to us, like, oh, sorry, I meant to do that thing, but I got distracted. And that's not, and your definition is, it's, you know, when someone tries to, you know, when someone tries to do multiple things, when you're trying to write something and then you also try to talk to someone else at the same time, or you also try to read something at the same time. And I don't know quite what I want you to tell me now while thinking about this, because there was just a lot of thinking, like, I don't know, like, I came here to sit down and listen to this talk, and that's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. And I'm not necessarily trying to do anything else, and yet my mind still wanders. And you know, it's something that also happens when you're sitting and meditating. So I guess I was just wondering if you could speak a little more on the, I don't know, the personal.
I think you have a good handle on it. Like this, like what I'm hearing from you is that you're recognizing, oh yeah, like there is, like, the part that I grab is like, when there's like volition in two different directions, like that's your responsibility. That's something that's like within your scope. And there's kind of a different interest in like, oh, how does that work? And I would say like, great, like investigate that, like see how it performs. and who you are while that's happening, because that's really fascinating.
Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe one more. Or not, if it's... But wait, Christine's had her hand up a long time.
Thank you. My name is Christine. I have a question about boredom, and not so much about the dullness, but that those moments where the excuse for distraction is boredom, and like the things that we have to do to get through something, like a meeting even, or a class, or something that's so repetitive that you're just kind of done with it. And they may not be dull at all, but the off ramp is boredom, and then an intolerance of what's occurring because of boredom. And I was just wondering if you could speak specifically to boredom.
Yeah. I think, I used to think like, oh, I don't ever get bored. I'm always like kind of excited about something, but it's not true. Like, I do get bored. it's a more subtle, it wasn't what I was classifying as boredom, but like the more subtle, like kind of like, like thready agitation. Sure. I think like it's kind of like a fingerprint. It's so personal. Or like what are the get really familiar with like your fingerprint of boredom, right? And I think to do that, like there's an acceptance, there's a compassion as part of it, you know, on the way in. But what I find is that like it's just so consistent. That's an important tell. And so the escape hatch is like recognizing that as pattern, right? And so like, you know, it's like there's vibrations, I hear things, like it's just like that kind of immediate, like causal, like mechanical, like it's not actually who I am, it's just stuff, it's just liquid neurotransmitting, right? Like and so it's less compelling. but like we get there by getting really familiar with our versions of it.
How about one comment from Tony?
It'll probably happen.
So I just remembered when the word boredom came up, I was taught that boredom arises from lack of attention. That's what it is. Do you have anything to say about that?
That sounds plausible. I think probably like there's some connecting dots that are important, and my guess as to them would be that there's a reason why the attention is lacking, and there's something about how we're framing the situation that makes us unwilling to put the attention there.
Yeah, but it can be very useful for that to come up because it pokes me into looking for just what you're talking about, right? So it's actually a very helpful reminder for a very helpful memory. Okay, thank you.
Yes, yes. All right. Thanks, y'all.